popular. It involved me calling down fire and lightning from the sky after the fashion of Tamerlane the Great. In my favorite version of the story, I met a helpful tinker on the road. I shared my dinner, and he told me of two children stolen from a nearby farm. Before I left, he sold me an egg, three iron nails, and a shabby cloak that could render me invisible. I used the items and my considerable wit to save the children from the clutches of a cunning, hungry trow. But while there were many versions of that tale, the story of Falurian was more popular by far. The song I'd written had made the journey west as well, and since songs hold their shape better than stories, the details about my encounter with Falurian were moderately close to the truth. When Will and Sim pressed me for details, I told them the whole story. It took me a while to convince them I was telling the truth. Rather, it took me a while to convince Sim. For some reason, Will was perfectly willing to accept the existence of the Fae. I didn't blame Sim. Until I saw her, I would have bet solid money Falurian didn't exist. It's one thing to enjoy a story, but it's quite another to take it for the truth.
The real question, Sim said thoughtfully, is how old you really are.
I know that one, Willem said with the somber pride of someone desperately pretending to not be drunk. 17.
Ah, Sim held up a finger dramatically. You'd think so, wouldn't you?
What are you talking about? I asked.
Sim leaned forward in his chair. You went into the Fae, spent some time there, then came out to discover only 3 days had passed, Sim said. Does that mean you're only 3 days older, or did you age while you were there?
I was quiet for a moment. I hadn't thought of that, I admitted.
In stories, Willem said, boys go into Fae and return as men. That implies one grows older.
If you're going to go by stories, Sim said.
What else? Will asked. Will you consult Marlock's Compendium of Fae Phenomenon? Find me such a book, and I will reference it.
Sim gave an agreeable shrug.
So?
Will said, turning to me.
How long were you there?
That's hard to figure, I said. There wasn't any day or night, and my memories are a bit odd. I thought for a long moment. We talked, swam, ate dozens upon dozens of times, explored a bit, and, well, I paused to clear my throat meaningfully.
Cavorted? Suggested Will.
Thank you. And cavorted quite a bit as well. I counted the skills Falurian had taught me, and then figured she couldn't have taught me more than 2 or 3 a day. It was at least a couple months, I said. I shaved once. Or was it twice? Time enough for me to grow a bit of a beard.
Will rolled his eyes at this, running his hand over his own dark sealedish beard.
Nothing like your marvelous face, Bear, I said. Still, mine grew out at least 2 or 3 times.
So, at least 2 months, Sim said. But how long could it have been?
3 months? How many stories had we shared? 4 or 5 months? I thought of how slowly we'd had to move my shade from starlight to moonlight to firelight. 1 year? I thought about the wretched time I'd spent recovering from my encounter with the Cathay.
I'm sure it couldn't have been more than 1 year.
My voice didn't sound nearly as convincing as I would have liked. Willem raised an eyebrow.
Well then, happy birthday!
He lifted his glass to me.
Or birthdays, depending.
Chapter 146. Failures. During spring term, I experienced several failures. The first of these was mostly a failure in my own eyes. I'd expected that picking up Yilish would be relatively easy, but nothing could have been further from the truth. In a handful of days, I had learned enough Tema to defend myself in court. But Tema was a very orderly language, and I'd already known a little bit from my studies. Perhaps, most importantly, there was a great deal of overlap between Tema and Aeturin. They used the same characters for writing, and many words are related.
Yilish shared nothing with Aturin, or Shaldish, or even with Ademic for that matter. It was an irrational, tangled mess. 14 indicative verb tenses, bizarre formal inflections of address. You couldn't merely say, the Chancellor sucks. Oh no. Too simple. All ownership was oddly dual, as if the Chancellor owned his socks, but at the same time, the socks somehow also gained ownership of the Chancellor. This altered the use of both words in complex grammatical ways, as if the simple act of owning socks somehow fundamentally changed the nature of a person. So even after months of study with the Chancellor, Yilish grammar was still a muddy jumble to me. All I had to show for my work was a messy smattering of vocabulary. My understanding of the story knots was even worse. I tried to improve matters by practicing with Diak, but he wasn't much of a teacher and admitted the only person he'd ever known who could read story knots had been his grandmother, who had died when he was very young. Second came my failure in advanced chemistry, taken under Mandrag's Giller, Anisat. While the material fascinated me, I did not get along with Anisat himself. I loved the discovery chemistry offered. I loved the thrill of experiment, the challenge of trial and retrial. I loved the puzzle of it. I also will admit a somewhat foolish fondness toward the apparatus involved. The bottles and tubes, the acids and salts, the mercury and flame. There is something primal in chemistry, something that defies explication. Either you feel it or you don't. Anisat didn't feel it. For him, chemistry was written journals and carefully penned rows of numbers. He would make me perform the same titration 4 times simply because my notation was incorrect. Why write a number down? Why should I take 10 minutes to write what my hands could finish in 5? So we argued, gently at first, but neither of us were willing to back down. As a result, barely 2 span into the term, we ended up shouting at each other in the middle of the crucible while 30 students looked on, open-mouthed with dismay. He told me to leave his class, calling me an irreverent dinnerling with no respect for authority. I called him a pompous slipstick who had missed his true calling as a counting house scribe. In all fairness, we both had some valid points. My other failure came in mathematics. After listening to Fella chatter excitedly for months about what she was learning under Master Brandur, I set out to further my number lore. Unfortunately, the loftier peaks of mathematics did not delight me. I am no poet. I do not love words for the sake of words. I love words for what they can accomplish. Similarly, I am no arithmetician. Numbers that speak only of numbers are of little interest to me. Due to my abandonment of chemistry and arithmetic, I had a great deal of free time on my hands. Some of this I spent in the fishery, making a bloodless of my own that sold practically before it hit the shelves. I also spent a fair amount of time in the archives and the Medica, doing research for an essay titled On the Non-Efficacy of Arrowroot. Arwill was skeptical, but agreed my initial research warranted attention. I also spent some of my time romantically. It was a new experience for me, as I had never caught the eye of women before. Or if I had, I hadn't known what to do with the attention. But I was older now, and wiser to some degree. And because of the stories circulating, women on both sides of the river were beginning to show an interest in me. My romances were all pleasant and brief. I cannot say why brief, except to state the obvious, that I do not have much in me that might encourage a woman to make long habit of my company. Simon, for example, had a great deal to offer. He was a gemstone in the rough, not stunning at first glance, but with a great deal of worth beneath the surface. Sim was tender, kind, and attentive as any woman could care for. He made Fella deliriously happy. Sim was a prince. By contrast, what did I have to offer? Nothing, really. Less now. I was more like a curious stone that is picked up, carried a while, and finally dropped again with the realization that for all its interesting look, it is nothing more than hardened earth. "Master Kilvin," I asked, "can you think of a metal that will stand hard use for 2,000 years and remain relatively unworn or unblemished?" The huge artificer looked up from the brass gear he was inscribing and eyed me standing in the doorway of his office.
And what manner of project are you planning now, Relarkwolf?
In the last 3 months, I've been trying to create another schema as successful as my bloodless. Partly for the money, but also because I'd learned that Kilvin was much more likely to promote students with 3 or 4 impressive schema to their credit. Unfortunately, I had met with a string of failures here, too. I'd had more than 12 clever ideas, none of which had led to a finished design. Most of the ideas were struck down by Kilvin himself. 8 of my clever ideas had already been created, some of them more than 100 years ago. 5 of them, Kilvin informed me, would require the use of runes that were forbidden to Relar. 3 of them were mathematically unsound, and he quickly sketched out how they were doomed to failure, saving me dozens of hours of wasted time. One of my ideas he rejected as
utterly inappropriate for a responsible artificer.
I argued that a mechanism that would cut the time needed to reload a ballista would help ships defend against piracy. It would help defend towns against attack by Visembi raiders. But Kilvin would hear none of it. When his face began to grow dark as a storm cloud, I quickly abandoned my carefully planned arguments. In the end, only 2 of my ideas were sound, acceptable, and original. But after weeks of work, I was forced to abandon them as well, unable to get them to work. Kilvin set down his stylus and half-inscribed brass gear, turning to face me.
I admire a student who thinks in terms of durability, Relarkwolf, but 1,000 years is a great deal to ask of stone, let alone metal, to say nothing of metal put to heavy use.
I was asking about Sasura, of course, but I hesitated to tell Kilvin the full truth. I knew all too well that the Master Artificer did not approve of artificery being used in conjunction with any sort of weapon. While he might appreciate the craftsmanship of such a sword, he would not think well of me for owning such a thing. I smiled. "It isn't for a project," I said. "I was just curious. During my travels, I was shown a sword that was quite serviceable and sharp. Despite this, there seemed to be proof that it was over 2,000 years old. Do you know of any metal that could avoid breaking for so long as that, let alone keep an edge?"
"Ah,"
Kilvin nodded, his expression not particularly surprised.
"There are such things, old magics, one could say. Or old arts now lost to us. These things are scattered through the world. Marvelous devices, mysteries. There are many reliable sources that speak of the ever-burning lamp."
He gestured with a broad hand at the hemispheres of glass laid out on his work table.
"We even possess a handful of these things here at the university."
I felt my curiosity flare up. "What sort of things?" I asked. Kilvin tugged his beard idly with one hand.
"I have a device devoid of any sigildry that seems to do nothing but consume angular momentum. I have 4 ingots of white metal, lighter than water, that I can neither melt nor mar in any way. A sheet of black glass, one side of which lacks any frictive properties at all. A piece of oddly shaped stone that maintains a temperature slightly above freezing, no matter what the heat around it."
His massive shoulders shrugged.
"These things are mysteries."
I opened my mouth, then hesitated. "Would it be inappropriate for me to ask to see some of these things?" Kilvin's smile was very white against the dark of his skin and his beard.
"It is never inappropriate to ask, Relarkwolf," he said. "A student should be curious. I would be troubled if you were indifferent to such things."
The big artificer went to his large wooden desk, so strewn with half-finished projects that the surface was barely visible. He unlocked a drawer with a key from his pocket and drew out 2 dull metal cubes, slightly larger than dice.
"Many of these old things we cannot fathom or make use of," he said, "but some possess remarkable utility."
He rattled the 2 metal cubes as if they were dice, and they rang together sweetly in his hand.
"We call these warding stones."
He bent and set them on the floor, spaced several feet apart from each other. He touched them and spoke very softly under his breath, too quietly for me to hear. I felt a subtle change in the air. At first, I thought that the room was growing colder, but then I realized the truth. I couldn't feel the radiant heat of the smoldering forge at the other end of Kilvin's office. Kilvin casually picked up the bar of iron used to stir the forge and swung it hard at my head. His gesture was so casual that it caught me completely off my guard, and I didn't even have time to cower or flinch away. The bar stopped 2 feet away from me, as if striking some unseen obstruction. There was no sound as if it had struck something, neither did it rebound in Kilvin's grip. I reached out my hand cautiously, and it butted up against nothing. It was as if the intangible air in front of me was suddenly made solid. Kilvin grinned at me.
The warding stones are of particular use when performing dangerous experiments or testing certain equipment, he said. They somehow produce a thaumic and kinetic barrier.
I continued to run my hand along the unseen barrier. It wasn't hard or even solid. It gave way slightly when I pushed at it and felt slippery as buttered glass. Kilvin watched me, his expression faintly amused.
Truthfully, Relarkvoth, until Elodin made his suggestion, I was thinking of calling your arrow-arresting device the Minor Ward.
He frowned slightly.
Not entirely accurate, of course, but more so than Elodin's dramatic nonsense.
I leaned hard against the unseen barrier. It was solid as a stone wall. Now that I was looking more closely, I could see a subtle distortion in the air, as if I were looking through a slightly imperfect sheet of glass. This is far superior to my arrow catch, Master Kilvin.
True.
Kilvin gave a conciliatory nod and bent to pick up the stones, muttering again under his breath. I staggered a little when the barrier disappeared.
But your cleverness we can repeat endlessly. This mystery we cannot.
Kilvin held up the 2 cubes of metal in the palm of his huge hand.
These are useful, but never forget. Cleverness and caution profit the artificer. We do our work in the realm of the real.
He closed his fingers over the warding stones.
Leave mystery to poets, priests, and fools.
Despite my other failures, my study with Master Elodin was progressing rather well. He claimed all I needed to improve myself as a namer was time and dedication. I gave him both, and he put them to use in odd ways. We spent hours riddling. He made me drink a pint of applejack, then read Tekum's Theophany from cover to cover. He made me wear a blindfold for 3 days straight, which didn't improve my performance in my other classes, but amused Will and Sim to no end. He encouraged me to see how long I could stay awake, and since I could afford all the coffee I liked, I managed nearly 5 days. Though, by the end, I was rather manic and starting to hear voices. And there was the incident on the roof of the archives. Everyone has heard about that in one version or another, it seems. There was a great beast of a thunderstorm rolling in, and Elodin decided it would do me good to spend some time in the middle of it. The closer the better, he said. He knew Lauren would never allow us access to the roof of the archives, so Elodin simply stole the key. Unfortunately, that meant that when the key went tumbling off the roof, no one knew we were trapped up there. As a result, the two of us were forced to spend the entire night on the bare stone rooftop, caught in the teeth of the furious storm. It wasn't until mid-morning that the weather calmed enough for us to call down to the courtyard for help. Then, as there didn't seem to be a second key, Lauren took the straightest course and had several burly scribes simply batter down the door leading to the roof. None of this would have been a particular problem if, just as it had started to rain, Elodin hadn't insisted that we strip ourselves naked, wrap our clothes in an oilskin, and weigh them down with a brick. According to Elodin, it would help me experience the storm to the fullest degree possible. The winds were stronger than he'd expected, and they had snatched both the brick and our bundled clothes, hurling them into the sky like a handful of leaves. That was how we lost the key, you see. It had been in the pocket of Elodin's pants. Because of this, Master Lauren, Lauren's Giller, Distral,
and three brawny scribes found Illodin and me stark naked and wet as drowned rats on the roof of the archives. Within 15 minutes, everyone in the university had heard the story. Illodin laughed his head off at the whole thing, and though I can see the humor of it now, at the time I was far from amused. I won't burden you with the entire list of our activities. Suffice to say that Illodin went to great lengths to wake my sleeping mind. Ridiculous lengths, really. And much to my surprise, our work paid dividends. I called the name of the wind 3 times that term. The first time I stilled the wind for the space of a long breath while standing on Stonebridge in the middle of the night. Illodin was there, coaching me. By which I mean he was prodding me with a riding crop. I was also barefoot, and more than slightly drunk. The second time came on me unexpectedly while I was studying in tomes. I was reading a book of Yilish history when suddenly the air in the cavernous room whispered to me. I listened as Illodin had taught me, then spoke it gently. Just as gently, the hidden wind stirred into a breeze, startling the students and sending the scrivs into a panic. The name faded from my mind some minutes later, but while it lasted, I held a certain knowledge that should I wish it, I could stir a storm or start a thunderclap with equal ease. The knowledge itself had to be enough for me. If I had called the wind's name strongly in the archives, Lauren would have me hung by my thumbs above the outer doors. You may not think these terribly impressive feats of naming, and I suppose you are right. But I called the wind a 3rd time that spring, and 3rd time pays for all.
Chapter 147. Debts. Since I had a great deal of free time on my hands midway through the term, I hired the use of a 2-horse fetter cart and headed to Tarbian on a bit of a lark. It took me all of Reaving to get there, and I spent most of Kendling visiting old haunts and paying old debts. A cobbler who had been kind to a shoeless boy. An innkeeper who had let me sleep on his hearth some nights. A tailor I had terrorized. Parts of Waterside were strikingly familiar, while other pieces I didn't recognize at all. That didn't particularly surprise me. A city as busy as Tarbian is constantly changing. What did surprise me was the strange nostalgia I felt for this place that had been so cruel to me. I had been gone for 2 years. For all practical purposes, it was a lifetime ago. It had been a span of days since the last rain, and the city was dry as a bone. The shuffling feet of 100,000 people kicked up a cloud of fine dust that filled the city streets. It covered my clothes and got in my hair and eyes, making them itch. I tried not to dwell on the fact that it was mostly pulverized horse shit with an assortment of dead fish, coal smoke, and urine thrown in for flavor. If I breathed through my nose, I was assaulted with the smell. But if I breathed through my mouth, I could taste it, and the dust filled my lungs, making me cough. I didn't remember it being as bad as this. Had it always been so dirty here? Had it always smelled this bad? After 30 minutes of searching, I finally found the burned-out building with a basement underneath. I made my way down the stairs and through the long hallway to a damp room. Trappist was still there, barefoot and wearing the same tattered robe, tending to his hopeless children in the cool dark below the city streets. He recognized me. Not as other people would, not as a budding hero out of stories. Trappist had no time for such things. He remembered me as the smudgy, starveling boy who fell down his stairs fever-sick and crying one winter night. You could say I loved him even more for that. I gave him as much money as he would take, 5 talents. I tried to give him more, but he refused. If he spent too much money, he said, it would attract the wrong sort of attention. He and his children were safest if nobody noticed them. I bowed to his wisdom and spent the remainder of the day helping him. I pumped water and fetched bread. I made a quick examination of the children, then took a trip to an apothecary and brought back a few things that would help. Lastly, I tended to Trappist himself, at least as much as he would allow. I rubbed his poor, swollen feet with camphor and mother's leaf, then made him a gift of tight-fitting stockings and a good pair of shoes so he wouldn't have to go barefoot in the damp of the basement anymore.
As the afternoon faded into evening, ragged children began to arrive in the basement. They came looking for a bit of food or because they were hurt and hoping for a safe place to sleep. They all eyed me suspiciously. My clothes were new and clean. I didn't belong there. I wasn't welcome. If I stayed, there would be trouble. At the very least, my presence would make some of the starveling children so uncomfortable they wouldn't stay the night. So I said goodbye to Trappist and left. Sometimes, leaving is the only thing you can do. Since I had a few hours before the tavern started to fill up, I bought a single piece of creamy writing paper and a matching envelope of heavy parchment. They were extremely fine quality, much nicer than anything I'd ever owned before. Next, I found a quiet cafe and ordered drinking chocolate with a glass of water. I arranged the paper on the table and brought out pen and ink from my shade. Then, I wrote in an elegant, fluid script. Ambrose, the child is yours. You know it is true and so do I. I fear my family will disown me. If you do not behave as a gentleman and see to your obligations, I will go to your father and tell him everything. Do not test me in this. I am resolved. I didn't sign a name, merely wrote a single initial which could have been an ornate R or perhaps a shaky B. Then, dipping my finger into my glass of water, I let several drops fall onto the page. They swelled the paper a bit and smeared the ink slightly before I blotted them away. They made a fair approximation of teardrops. I let one final heavy drop fall under the initial I'd signed, obscuring it even more. Now the letter looked as if it could also be an F or a P or an E, perhaps even a K. It could be anything, really. I folded the paper carefully, then walked over to one of the room's lamps and melted a generous blob of sealing wax onto the fold. On the outside of the envelope, I wrote, Ambrose Jackis, University, 2 miles west of Imray, Bellany Baron, Central Commonwealth. I paid for my drink and headed to Drover's Lot. When I was just a few streets away, I removed my shade and tucked it into my travel sack. Then I dropped the letter in the street and stepped on it, scuffing it around with my foot a bit before picking it up and brushing it off. I was almost to the square when I saw the final thing I needed. "Hoy there," I said to an old, whiskery man sitting against a building. "I'll give you halfpenny if you let me borrow your hat." The old man pulled the draggled thing off and looked at it. His head was very bald and very pale underneath. He squinted a bit in the late afternoon sunlight.
"My hat?" he asked, his voice rough. "You can have it for a whole penny, and my blessing, too."
He gave a hopeful grin as he held out a thin, shaky hand. I gave him a penny. "Could you hold this for a second?" I passed him the envelope, then used both hands to screw the old, shapeless hat down over my ears. I used a nearby shop window to make sure every scrap of my red hair was tucked away underneath.
"Suits you," the old man said, giving a phlegmy cough.
I reclaimed the letter and eyed the smudgy fingerprints he'd left. From there, it was a quick step to Drover's Square. I slouched a bit and narrowed my eyes as I wandered through the milling throng. After a couple minutes, my ear caught the distinctive sound of a southern vintage accent, and I walked over to a handful of men loading a wagon with burlap sacks.
"Hoy," I said, putting on the same accent. "You folk heading up Imray way?"
One of the men heaved his sack into the wagon and walked over, dusting off his hands.
"Heading through there," he said. "You looking for a ride?"
I shook my head and brought the letter out of my travel sack.
"I've got a letter for up that way. I was going to take it myself, but my ship sails tomorrow. I bought it from a sailor off in Gannery for a full quarter bit," I said. "He had it himself off some noble gal for a single bit," I winked. "She was quite urgent that it get to him, I hear." "You paid a quarter bit," the man said, already shaking his head. "Yeah, grummer. Ain't nobody gonna pay that much for a letter."
"Eh?"
I said, holding up a finger.
"You ain't seen who it's for yet."
I held it up for him to see. He squinted.
"Jackis,"
he said slowly. Then his face lit with recognition.
"Is that Baron Jackis's boy, then?"
I nodded smugly. The eldest himself. Boy rich as that should pay a fair piece for a letter from his lady. Much as whole noble, I figure.
He eyed the letter.
Could be, he said cautiously.
But look, it ain't got anything on it other than university. I've been up that way. That ain't a small place.
Baron Jackus's boy ain't going to sleep in a tin shack, I said crossly. Ask someone what the fanciest place is. That's where he'll be.
The man nodded to himself, his hand creeping unconsciously toward his purse.
I suppose I could take it off your hands,
he said grudgingly.
But only at a quarter bit. I'm taking a risk anyways at that.
Have a heart now, I protested pitifully. I brought it 800 miles. That's worth better than nothing.
Fine, he said, pulling coins out of his purse. I'll give you 3 bits then.
I'd take half a round, I grumbled.
You'll take 3 bits, he said, holding out a grubby hand.
I handed him the letter.
Remember to tell him it's from a noble lady, I said as I turned to leave.
Rich Tosh, get whatever you can off him, that's what I say.
I left the square, then straightened my shoulders and took off the hat. I pulled my shade back out of my travel sack and swirled it easily around my shoulders. I started to whistle, and as I passed the bald old beggar, I returned his hat and gave him the 3 bits besides. When I first heard the stories people were telling about me at the university, I'd expected them to be short-lived. I thought they would flare up, then die just as quickly, like a fire exhausting its fuel. But that hadn't been the case. The tales of Quoth rescuing girls and bedding Felurian mixed and mingled with scraps of truth and the ridiculous lies I'd spread to bolster my reputation. There was fuel aplenty, so the stories swirled and spread like a brush fire with the wind blowing hard behind it. Honestly, I didn't know if I should be amused or alarmed. When I went to Imre, people would point at me and whisper to each other. My notoriety spread until it was impossible for me to casually cross the river and eavesdrop on the stories people told. Tarbian, on the other hand, was 40 miles away. After I left Drover's lot behind, I returned to the room I'd rented in one of the nicer parts of Tarbian. In this part of the city, the wind off the ocean brushed away the stink and the dust, leaving the air feeling sharp and clear. I called up water for a bath, and in a fit of lavish spending that would have left my younger self dizzy, I paid 3 pennies to have the porter take my clothes to the nearest Sealdish laundry. Then, clean and sweet-smelling again, I went down to the taproom. I'd picked the inn carefully. It wasn't fancy, but it wasn't seedy either. The taproom was low-ceilinged and intimate. It sat at the corner of 2 of Tarbian's most well-traveled roads, and I could see Sealdish traders rubbing elbows with Yilish sailors and Vintish wagoneers. It was the perfect place for stories. It wasn't long before I was lurking at the end of the bar, listening to how I had killed the black beast of Traben. I was stunned. I had actually killed a rampaging Dracus in Traben, but when Nina had come to visit me a year ago, she hadn't known my name. My growing reputation had somehow swept through the town of Traben and gathered up that story in its wake. There at the bar, I learned many things. Apparently, I owned a ring of amber which could force demons to obey me. I could drink all night and never be the worse for it. Locks opened at the barest touch of my hand, and I had a cloak made all out of cobwebs and shadows. That was also the first time I heard anyone call me Quoth the Arcane. It was not a new name, apparently. The cluster of men listening to the story simply nodded along when they heard it. I learned that Quoth the Arcane knew a word that would stop arrows dead in the air. Quoth the Arcane only bled if the knife that cut him was made of raw, untempered iron. The young clerk was building to the dramatic finish of the story, and I was genuinely curious as to how I was going to stop the demon beast with my ring shattered and my cloak of shadows nearly burned away. But just as I forced my way into Traben's church, shattering the door with a magic word and a single blow of my bare hand, the door of the inn burst open, startling everyone as it banged hard against the wall. A young couple stood there.
The woman was young and beautiful, dark-haired and dark-eyed. The man was richly dressed and pale with panic.
"I don't know what's the matter," he cried, looking about wildly. "We were just walking, and then she couldn't breathe."
I was at her side before anyone else in the room had time to stand. She had half collapsed onto an empty bench, with her escort hovering over her. She had one hand pressed against her chest, while the other pushed him away weakly. The man ignored it and crowded close to her, speaking in a low, urgent voice. The woman kept sliding away from him until she was at the edge of the bench. I pushed him ungently aside. "I think she wants her space from you right now."
"Who are you?"
he demanded, his voice shrill.
"Are you a physician? Who is this man? Someone fetch a physician at once!"
He tried to elbow me aside.
"You!"
I pointed to a large sailor sitting at a table. "Take this man and put him over there." My voice snapped like a whip, and the sailor jumped to his feet, grabbed the young gentleman by the back of his neck, and scuffed him tidily away. I turned back to the woman and watched as her perfect mouth opened. She strained and drew in only the barest rasp of a breath. Her eyes were wild and wet with fear. I moved close to her and spoke in my gentlest tones. "You will be fine. All is well," I reassured her. "You need to look in my eyes." Her eyes fixed on mine, then widened in recognition, in amazement. "I need you to breathe for me." I laid one hand against her straining chest. Her skin was flushed and hot. Her heart was thrilling like a frightened bird. I laid my other hand along her face. I looked deeply into her eyes. They were like dark pools. I leaned close enough to kiss her. She smelled of celis flower, of green grass, of road dust. I felt her strain to breathe. I listened. I closed my eyes. I heard the whisper of a name. I spoke it soft, but close enough to brush against her lips. I spoke it quiet, but near enough so that the sound of it went twining through her hair. I spoke it hard and firm and dark and sweet. There was a rush of indrawn air. I opened my eyes. The room was still enough that I could hear the velvet rush of her second desperate breath. I relaxed. She laid her hand over mine, over her heart. "I need you to breathe for me," she repeated. "That's 7 words."
"It is," I said.
"My hero," Dennis said, and drew a slow and smiling breath.
"It were powerful strange," I heard the sailor say on the other side of the room. "There was summat in his voice. I swear by all the salt in me, I felt like a puppet with my string pulled."
I listened with half an ear. I guessed the deckhand simply knew to jump when a voice with the proper ring of authority told him to. But there was no sense in telling him that. My performance with Denna, combined with my bright hair and dark cloak, had identified me as Kvothe. So it would be magic, no matter what I had to say about it. I didn't mind. What I had done tonight was worthy of a story or two. Because they recognized me, folk were watching us, but not coming very close. Denna's gentleman friend had left before we thought to look for him. So the two of us enjoyed a certain privacy in our small corner of the tap room. "I should have known I'd come across you here," she said. "You're always where I least expect to find you. Have you migrated away from the university at last?" I shook my head. "I'm playing truant for a couple days." "Are you heading back soon?"
"Tomorrow, actually. I've got a fetter cart."
She smiled. "Would you like some company?" I gave her a frank look.
"You must know the answer to that."
Denna blushed a little and looked away. "I suppose I do." When she looked down, her hair cascaded off her shoulders, falling around her face. It smelled warm and rich, like sunshine and cider. "Your hair," I said.
"Lovely."
Surprisingly, she blushed even deeper at this and shook her head without looking up at me. "So that's what we've come to after all this time," she said, darting a look up at me. "Flattery?" It was my turn to be embarrassed, and I stammered.
I wouldn't... I mean, I would. I took a breath before reaching out to lightly touch a narrow, intricate braid half hidden in her hair.
Your braid, I clarified.
It almost says lovely. Her mouth made a perfect O of surprise, and one hand went self-consciously to her hair.
You can read it?
She said, her voice incredulous, her expression slightly horrified.
Merciful Talu, isn't there anything you don't know?
I've been learning Yilish, I said. Or trying to. It's got 6 strands instead of 4, but it's almost like a story knot, isn't it?
Almost? She said.
It's a damn sight more than almost. Her fingers plucked at the piece of blue string at the end of her braid. Even Yilish folk barely know Yilish these days, she said under her breath, plainly irritated.
I'm not any good, I said. I just know some words.
Even the ones that do speak it don't bother with the knots, she glared sideways at me. And you're supposed to read them with your fingers, not by looking at them.
I've mostly had to learn by looking at pictures in books, I said.
Denna finally untied the blue string and began to unfurl the braid, her quick fingers smoothing it back into her hair.
You didn't have to do that, I said. I liked it better before.
That's rather the point, isn't it? She looked up at me, tilting her chin proudly as she shook out her hair.
There. What do you think now?
I think I'm afraid to give you any more compliments, I said, not exactly sure what I'd done wrong. Her demeanor softened a bit, her irritation fading.
It's just embarrassing. I never expected anyone to be able to read it. How would you feel if someone saw you wearing a sign that said, I'm dashing and handsome?
There was a pause. Before it could grow uncomfortable, I said, Am I keeping you from anything pressing?
Only Squire Strahota.
She made a negligent gesture toward her departed escort.
Pressing, was he?
I gave a half-smile, raising an eyebrow.
All men press one way or another, she said with mock severity.
They're still keeping to their book, then?
Denna's expression grew rueful, and she sighed. I used to hope they'd disregard the book with age. Instead, I found they merely turned a page.
She held up her hand, displaying a pair of rings.
Now instead of roses, they give gold, and in the giving, they grow sudden bold.
At least you're being bored by men of means, I said consolingly.
Who wants a mean man?
She pointed out. Little matter if his wealth is above or below the board.
I laid a gentling hand on her arm. You must forgive these men of mercenary thought.
These poor, rich men who, seeing that you can't be caught, attempt to buy a thing they know cannot be bought.
Denna applauded delightedly. A plea of grace for enemies.
I merely point out that you yourself are not above the giving of gifts, I said, as I myself well know.
Her eyes hardened, and she shook her head. There is a great difference between a gift freely given and one that's meant to tie you to a man.
There's truth to that, I admitted. Gold can make a chain as easily as iron. Still, one can hardly blame a man who hopes to decorate you.
Hardly, she said with a smile that was both wry and weary. Many of their suggestions are rather indecorous.
She looked at me.
What of you? Would you have me decorated or indecorous?
I have given some thought to that, I said with a secret smile, knowing I had her ring tucked safely away in my room at Anchor's. I made a show of looking her over.
Both have their merits, but gold is not for you. You are too bright for burnishing.
Denna gripped my arm and squeezed it, giving me a fond smile.
Oh, my Quoth, I've missed you. Half the reason I came back to this corner of the world was in the hope of finding you.
She stood and held out her arm to me.
Come, take me away from all this.
Chapter 148, The Stories of Stones. On the long ride back to Imre, Denna and I spoke of 100 small things. She told me about the cities she had seen, Tinue, Vartharet, and Denevan.
I told her about Ademre and showed her a few pieces of hand language. She teased me about my growing fame, and I told her the truth behind the stories. I told her how things had fallen out with the mayor, and she was properly outraged on my behalf. But there was much we didn't discuss. Neither of us mentioned how we'd parted ways in Severn. I didn't know if she had left in anger after our argument, or if she thought I had abandoned her. Any question seemed dangerous. Such a discussion would be uncomfortable at best. At worst, it might reignite our previous argument, and that was something I was desperate to avoid. Denna carried her harp with her, as well as a large traveling trunk. I guessed her song was finished, and she must be performing it. It bothered me that she would play it in Imre, where countless singers and minstrels would hear and carry it out across the world. Despite this, I said nothing. I knew that would be a hard conversation, and I needed to pick the time for it carefully. Neither did I mention her patron, though what the cafe had told me preyed on my mind. I thought on it endlessly, had dreams about it. Falurian was another matter we didn't discuss. For all the jokes Denna made about my rescuing bandits and killing virgins, she never mentioned Falurian. She must have heard the song I'd written, as it was much more popular than the other stories she seemed to know so well. But she never mentioned it, and I was not enough of a fool to bring it up myself. So as we rode, there were many things unspoken. The tension built in the air between us as the road jounced away beneath the cart's wheels. There were gaps and breaks in our conversation. Silences that stretched too long. Silences that were short, but terrifyingly deep. We were trapped in the middle of one of those silences when we finally arrived in Imre. I dropped her off at the Boar's Head, where she planned to take rooms. I helped her carry her trunk upstairs, but the silence was even deeper there. So I skirted hastily around it, bid her a fond farewell, and fled without so much as kissing her hand. That night, I thought of 10,000 things I could have said to her. I lay awake, staring at the ceiling, unable to sleep until the deep, late hours of night. I woke early, feeling anxious and uneasy. I had breakfast with Simon and Fella, then went to Adept Sympathy, where Fenton beat me handily 3 duels in a row, setting him in the top rank for the first time since I'd returned to the university. With no other classes, I bathed and spent long minutes looking through my clothes before deciding on a simple shirt and the green vest Fella said set off my eyes. I worked my shade into a short cape, then decided not to wear it. I didn't want Denna thinking of Falurian when I came to call. Lastly, I slipped Denna's ring into my vest pocket and set off across the river to Imre. Once at the Boar's Head, I hardly had a chance to touch the door handle before Denna opened it and stepped out onto the street, handing me a basket lunch. I was more than slightly surprised. "How did you know?" She wore a pale blue dress that flattered her and smiled winsomely as she linked arms with me.
"Women's intuition."
"Ah," I said, trying to sound wise. The nearness of her was almost painful. The warmth of her hand on my arm. The smell of her like green leaves and the air before a summer storm. "Do you know where we are bound as well?"
"Only that you will take me there."
When she spoke, she turned to face me, and I felt her breath against the side of my neck.
"I gladly leave my trust in you."
I turned to face her, thinking to say one of the clever things I'd thought of last night. But when I met her eyes, all words left me. I was lost in wonder. For how long, I cannot even guess. For a long moment, I was wholly hers. Denna laughed, jogging me from a reverie that might have stretched a moment or a minute. We made our way out of town, talking as easily as if there had never been a thing between us but sunlight and spring air. I led her to a place I'd found earlier that spring, a small dell sheltered by the backs of trees. A stream meandered past a graystone that lay lengthwise on the ground, and the sun shone on a field of bright daisies stretching their faces to the sky. Denna caught her breath when we crested the ridge and saw the carpet of daisies open out in front of her. "I've waited a long time to show these flowers how pretty you are," I said. That won me an enthusiastic embrace and a kiss burning on my cheek. Both were over before I knew they'd begun. Bemused and grinning, I led the way through the daisies to the graystone near the stream. I removed my shoes and socks. Denna kicked off her shoes and tied up her skirts. Then she ran to the center of the stream until the water rose past her knees.
"Do you know the secret of stones?"
she asked as she reached into the water. The hem of her dress dipped into the stream, but she seemed unconcerned.
"What secret is that?"
She drew up a smooth, dark stone from the stream bed and held it out to me.
"Come see."
I finished cuffing up my pants and made my way into the water. She held up the dripping stone.
"If you hold it in your hand and listen to it..."
She did so, closing her eyes. She stood still for a long moment, her face turned upward like a flower. I was drawn to kiss her, but I resisted. Finally, she opened her dark eyes. They smiled at me.
"If you listen close enough, it will tell you a story."
"What story did it tell you?" I asked.
"Once there was a boy who came to the water," Dennis said. "This is the story of a girl who came to the water with the boy. They talked, and the boy threw the stones as if casting them away from himself. The girl didn't have any stones, so the boy gave her some. Then she gave herself to the boy, and he cast her away as he would a stone, unmindful of any falling she might feel."
I was quiet for a moment, not sure if she was done.
"It's a sad stone, then?"
She kissed the stone and dropped it, watching as it settled to the sand.
"No, not sad, but it was thrown once. It knows the feel of motion. It has trouble staying the way most stones do. It takes the offer that the water makes and moves sometimes."
She looked up at me and gave a guileless smile.
"When it moves, it thinks about the boy."
I didn't know what to make of the story, so I tried to change the subject. "How did you learn to listen to stones?"
"You'd be amazed the things you hear if only you take time to listen."
She gestured to the stream bed strewn with stones.
"Try it. You never know what you might hear."
Not sure what game she was playing at, I looked around for a stone, then cuffed up my shirt sleeve and reached into the water.
"Listen,"
she prompted earnestly. Thanks to my studies with Elodin, I had a high tolerance for the ridiculous. I held the stone to my ear and closed my eyes. I wondered if I should pretend to hear a story. Then I was in the water, wet to the skin and spitting it. I spluttered and struggled to my feet while Denna laughed so hard she doubled over at the waist, barely able to stand. I moved toward her, but she skipped away with a little shriek that left her laughing even harder. So I held off chasing and made a show of wiping water from my face and arms.
"Give up so easily," she taunted. "Are you so sudden doused?"
I lowered my hand into the water. "I was hoping to find my stone again," I said, pretending to look around for it. Denna laughed, shaking her head.
"You'll not lure me in that easily."
"I'm serious," I said. "I wanted to hear the end of its story."
"What story was that?"
she asked teasingly, not coming any closer. "It was a story of a girl who trifled with a powerful arcanist," I said. "She mocked him, and she scoffed at him. She laughed at him full scornfully. He caught her one day in a brook, and rhyming, he did quell her fears. And then the girl forgot to look behind her, and it led to tears." I grinned at her and pulled my hand out of the water. She turned in time for the wave to hit her. It was only as high as her waist, but it was enough to unbalance her. She went under in a swirl of dress and hair and bubbles. The current carried her to me, and I helped her to her feet, laughing. She came to the surface looking 3 days drowned.
"Not fair," she sputtered indignantly. "Not fair."
"I disagree," I said. "You're the fairest water maid I hope to see today." She splashed at me.
"Flatter all you like. The truth remains for God to see. You cheated. I used honest trickery."
She tried to dunk me then, but I was ready for it. We struggled for a while until we were pleasantly breathless.
Only then did I realize how close she was. How lovely. How little our wet clothing seemed to separate us. Denna seemed to realize it at the same time, and we moved a little apart from each other, as if suddenly shy. The wind stirred, reminding us how wet we were. Denna skipped lightly to the shore and stripped away her dress without a moment's hesitation, tossing it over the graystone to dry. She wore a white shift underneath that clung to her as she made her way back into the water. She gave me a playful push as she passed me by, then crawled atop a smooth black boulder that lay half-submerged near the center of the stream. It was a perfect sunning stone, smooth basalt, dark as her eyes. The whiteness of her skin and the too revealing shift were a sharp contrast against it, almost too bright to look on. She lay on her back and spread her hair to dry. Its wetness made a pattern against the stone that spelled the name of the wind. She closed her eyes and tipped her face toward the sun. Valurian herself could not have been more lovely, more perfectly at ease. I moved toward the shore as well and stripped off my sodden shirt and vest. I had to be content with my wet pants, as I had nothing else to wear. "What does that stone tell you?" I asked to fill the silence as I laid my shirt next to her dress on the graystone. She ran one hand over the smooth surface of the stone and spoke without opening her eyes. "This one is telling me what it is like to live in the water but not be a fish." She stretched like a cat. "Bring the basket over here, would you?" I fetched the basket and waded out toward her, moving slowly so as not to splash. She lay perfect and still, as if asleep, but as I watched, her mouth curved into a smile. "You're quiet," she said. "But I can smell you standing there."
"Nothing bad, I hope."
She shook her head gently, still not opening her eyes. "You smell like dried flowers, like strange spice smoldering, close to catching flame."
"Like river water, too, if I have any guess."
She stretched again and smiled an easy smile, showing the perfect whiteness of her teeth, the perfect pinkness of her lips. She shifted her position on the rock slightly, almost as if she were making room for me. Almost. I thought of joining her. The stone was large enough for two if they were willing to lie close.
"Yes," Denna said.
"Yes to what?" I asked.
"Your question," she said, tilting her face toward me,
her eyes still closed.
"You're about to ask me a question."
She adjusted her position slightly on the stone.
"The answer is yes."
How was I to take that? What should I ask for? A kiss? More? How much was too much to ask? Was this a test? I knew asking too much would only drive her away.
"I was wondering if you would move over a little," I said gently. "Yes."
She shifted again, making more space beside her. Then she opened her eyes, and they went wide at the sight of me standing shirtless above her. She glanced down and relaxed when she saw my pants. I laughed, but her wide-eyed look of shock pushed me back into caution. I set the basket in the place I had thought to take myself.
"What thought was that, my lady?"
She colored a bit, embarrassed.
"I didn't think you were the sort to bring a girl her lunch while you were running stark."
She gave a little shrug, looked at the basket, at me.
"But I like you this way, my own bare-chested slave."
She closed her eyes again.
"Feed me strawberries."
I was happy to oblige, and so we passed the afternoon. Lunch was long gone, and the sun had dried us. For the first time since our fight in Severin, I felt things were right between us. The silences no longer lay around us like holes in the road. I knew it had just been a matter of waiting patiently until the tension passed. As the afternoon slowly slid by, I knew this was the right time to bring up the subject I had been biting my tongue over for so long. I could see the dull green of old bruises on her upper arms, the remnant of a raised welt on her back. There was a scar on her leg above her knee, new enough that the red of it showed through the white of her shift. All I needed to do was ask about them. If I phrased things carefully, she'd admit they were from her patron. From there, it would be a simple thing to draw her out, to convince her she deserved better, that whatever he was offering her was not worth this abuse. And for the first time in my life, I was in a position to offer her a way out. With Alvaron's line of credit and my work